WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. Doogie Howser lost his virginity on TV last night. Murphy Brown is pregnant, and Prince recently exposed his behind during the MTV Awards. Sex permeates our culture. But when the Kinsey Institute for Sex Research recently tested the basic sexual knowledge of American adults, more than half failed the test. My guest, Dr. June Reinisch, is the director of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University, which was one of the first academic organizations to study human sexual behavior when it was established 50 years ago. They've conducted more than 17,000 interviews with adults about their sexual behavior. Dr. Reinisch also writes a syndicated newspaper column called The Kinsey Report. She's drawn from the many questions people send her for her new book, The Kinsey Institute New Report on Sex. Their first report came out in the late 40s. I asked Dr. Reinisch what Americans have learned about sex since then.
Not much, it seems. Of course, the original Kinsey reports that everybody remembers, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, which came out in 1948, and Sexual Behavior in the Human Female, which was published in 1953, were about sexual behavior. And there has been several major changes in behavior since the 40s, although certainly not the revolution that people like to talk about.
Like what?
I call it a sexual evolution. Well, I would say that the three major changes are, first, that more people are having sex before marriage, that is, premarital sex. The frequency of it in the population is higher. In Kinsey's time, for instance, in women, 50% of women had had sex before they got married. Many of those had it with the man that they eventually married. Today, about 90% of women have sex before they're married, so that's a major difference. The second major difference is the number of partners. In the 40s and the 50s, people perhaps had one partner and men a few more before they got married. Then they got married and they usually had one marriage for their whole lives. If they were going to have additional partners, they had to be extramarital partners. Today, people begin earlier, so they have more premarital partners, and then they are likely to have several marital partners because of the divorce rate in our country. And of course, between marriages, they have what I call intermarital partners. That is, those partners that you're looking out and evaluating to decide whether you want to marry them or not. So people have more partners, they have more sex and somewhat earlier sex before marriage. The third major difference in the sexual evolution is that you and I can sit here on radio and talk about anything we want when it comes to sex, as long as it's done seriously.
Sex is no longer a taboo, and as you said earlier, it's talked about all the time, everywhere. You can turn on the TV, read books, magazines, newspapers. Everyone's talking about sex. And I think it's also true that it's a highly charged sexual environment. I think just the way that it's used to sell products. Do people have to actively resist information to keep themselves in the dark about sex?
Well, first of all, no. It is still the most taboo subject, I believe, in American society. And in fact, there's very little really good information out there. That's the problem. There's a lot of reference to sexuality. And what is shown and depicted is a very, very narrow range of sexuality. I mean, basically what you get in the media is kiss, kiss, fall into bed. You know, that's the range of information. Of course, sexuality information is much wider than that and includes all kinds of things like contraception and reproduction and development and aging and health and so forth. And there's very little of that information out there. So people are not ignorant because they're stupid. They're ignorant because the vast majority of Americans have never had even a reasonable sex education course. And there are not a whole lot of good resources out there where they can get facts that are based on good research. And so that's why we felt this was an essential book to present to the public.
What you're saying is people get hung up on things like G-spots and love maps and other
right.
kinds of...
Well, they don't get hung up on it. It's what's presented to them by the media, and they don't get a really well-rounded information. The average high school student today, about 1 out of 10 of high school students gets what would be considered a comprehensive sex education course. Even today, when I grew up, the one thing you got is a movie on menstruation, and the boys weren't even allowed to see it. So, and that was the entire sex education for my whole high school and junior high school. And interestingly, you know, when the Harris Poll people ask Americans on a regular basis whether or not they want sex education, in 1989, for example, 89% 40% of Americans said yes, they wanted sex education in the schools, and 50% approximately said they wanted it to start in elementary school. But that's the silent majority, and there's a small group of 11 to 15% who are against sex education and are very, very vocal and outspoken and go to all the meetings and fight it. And they're people who believe one of the great American myths about sexuality, of which we have many. They believe that sex education causes young people to be sexually active, when in fact the research tells us the exact opposite. That is, that a good comprehensive sex education course with access to contraception not only lowers the teen pregnancy rate, which, by the way, the United States has the worst in the Western industrialized world, but it also delays the age at first intercourse. So young people who have had a good comprehensive sex education course are more likely to wait longer before they have sexual intercourse.
Well, where do these ideas come from that somehow if you talk to teens about sex, that then they will want to have sex?
Well, we've got lots of myths like that that come from different places. That specific one, I think, just comes from A, lack of research, and B, people's belief that that's what it ought to do. And so people act as if and talk as if they know that that's what sex education does, and they don't look at the research. For instance, masturbation is still one of the most taboo of the taboo subjects. And I get thousands of letters each year from people writing to me about their fears that masturbation is going to hurt them in some way or interfere with their fertility. Young people write, will I use up all my sperm? Will I use up all my eggs and not be able to have babies if I masturbate? Will I somehow get ill from it? Will I not be able to make love to a partner? Old people write to us after they've lost their partners and start to masturbate at 70 or 80, and then they worry whether they're going to hurt themselves in some way, all of which, of course, is not true. In fact, the latest research tells us that postmenopausal women who do not have a regular sexual partner, if they masturbate to orgasm regularly, it will help to keep their urinary and genital tracts healthy. But where did that come from? Well, if you go back to the early 1800s or the mid-1800s, in 1948, there was a man named Sylvester Graham, and he invented the Graham cracker. He invented that Graham cracker as an anti-lust food. This is true now. This is history. He believed that having sex more than once a month would be very detrimental to your health, and it would cause everything from physical problems like tuberculosis to insanity to mental retardation to your children being defective when they were born. And so he invented Graham crackers so that you would eat them in the morning, they would lower your lust, and then you wouldn't have sex more than once a month, which is what they recommended. He wrote a book. It was widely considered to be accurate and good information. Physicians all over the United States accepted it. 20 years later, approximately, a man named John Harvey Kellogg came along. He invented the Kellogg's cornflake. He also believed that sex was very bad for you and you shouldn't have it more than once a month. And he was also even more negative about masturbation, all the terrible things it could do. And he invented Kellogg's cornflakes so that you would eat them in the morning, they would lower your lust, and then you wouldn't have sex or masturbate. And he also wrote a book that was very influential, and our ideas about all their myths about the bad things that would happen to you from masturbation are still alive today in the United States.
How much information do we have about if you know about safe sex, that you will engage in safe sex? For instance, if you have sex education and you talk to, we'll say, school-age children and, right, and young adults about what kind of sex to engage in or to not engage, right, in, what's the possibility that they're actually going to engage in safe sex? The reason I ask that, I think, is that on college campuses, which we can assume have had some information, perhaps I'm overestimating that, but have, mm-hmm, had some information about, mm-hmm, the results of engaging in unprotected sex. And yet what we hear from college campuses is that people don't use condoms, that they haven't, yeah, really changed their behavior.
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting area. We've just finished two studies of a major Midwest university, and you're right. There has not been an enormous change in responsibility with regard to sexually transmitted disease protection on the college campus. First of all, let me say that college campuses do not get comprehensive sex education courses. It's not good enough to tell people to just say no or to use a condom. You know, it took us 20 years to start to make a dent in the smoking in Americans. 20 years of education before that really changed. It's the same for seatbelts. It took, I don't know, 12 or 15 years. And scaring people doesn't work. That's how we started with the smoking. We showed them lungs that were eaten up and black, and we showed them corpses. And you know what? People turn off when you scare them too much, and they don't even hear what you're trying to say to them. And the college campuses in general, although some are really trying, but in general, are not providing all their students with comprehensive sex education. We have other problems with regard to this. And that is that another of America's myths, and I like to think of this book as a myth buster, but another one of America's myths is that intercourse is the only sex that really counts. It's the only mature sex. It's the only real sex. And that gets us into a lot of trouble all along people's lives and at every age. For instance, in young people, do you know that young people have sexual intercourse, penile-vaginal intercourse, before they have oral sex in this country? Oral sex, of course, is much safer in terms of pregnancy. It's, in fact, completely safe in terms of pregnancy. And also, it is not as easy to transmit any sexually transmitted disease or most sexually transmitted diseases with oral sex as it is with sexual intercourse. And yet, we have convinced our young people that the only sex that really counts is intercourse, and that's what they should be doing first, and sure enough, they are. In older people, when something happens by, for instance, taking medication that might affect erection in the male or being ill or something that does affect erectile ability, in many older couples, that signals the end of all touching, kissing, holding hands, cuddling, and sometimes even couples write to me that they've moved into separate rooms, all because the man has lost his erectile ability because intercourse is what counts. And it's wrong. That's not true. And it limits us all along the way and causes problems.
How has AIDS changed what people know about sex, how they talk about sex, how they even think about sex?
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the questions on the test asked, a person can get AIDS by having anal intercourse even if neither partner is infected with the AIDS virus. And you would think that 150 years after Pasteur proved that germs were necessary for disease, that very few people would get that question wrong. In fact, 50% of Americans believe that anal intercourse alone can cause AIDS. So the education process is really only in its beginning stages of the American people.
Dr. June Reinisch is my guest. She's the director of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. And since the 1940s, the Kinsey Institute has been surveying Americans on what they know about sex. And as it turns out, it's not very much. The latest report in 1989 gave most Americans a failing grade when it came to sex literacy. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Dr. June Reinisch is my guest, and she's the director of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. What are some of the most common questions you get at the Institute about sex?
The number one question that we get from both males and females is on erection problems. This is an area that seems to concern men and women in this country tremendously. And I think it does, because if we consider intercourse to be the only and most important sexual act, then if that is interfered with in some way, the whole sex life and the whole affection life of that couple suffers tremendously. And so both men and women are very concerned about that. The second most asked questions nowadays are about sexually transmitted diseases. All STDs, symptoms, treatments, safeguards, a lot of people go to their family doctor or to their gynecologist when they have one of these diseases. And sometimes, particularly if it's chronic, the solution is not found, and they try all kinds of things and they're very frustrated. And of course, what we recommend is, and this is even with chronic yeast infections that are not necessarily sexually transmitted, we suggest that you go to a sexually transmitted disease clinic, an STD clinic at a major hospital or university medical center, because the STD physicians are really expert at dealing with infections in that whole area, and they're also very up to date on what the newest treatments are and are trained in those new treatments. So that's a suggestion we make over and over again.
Are men still concerned about the size of their penis?
That's the number two question asked by men, followed by erection problems, is penis size and appearance. It's number three overall. That's how many people ask us about it. So if men and women together, even though the women don't ask questions about this, and mostly men are concerned about size. They have a belief that women, that penis size, having a large penis, is very important to women's arousal and valuing of a man, when in fact, about 9 out of 10 women don't even mention penis size as even in on the list of things that are important to them. But when we do get letters from women, it's the opposite of men would think. The few letters that we get are usually from women who have partners with penises that are too large for them and are asking for advice as to what positions to use to have more comfortable intercourse.
Well, if you're talking about impotence and penis size, are you really talking about men and their concerns about performance or performance anxiety, that's kind of at the root of their questions?
Well, I think that's a good analysis. However, the erection problems are asked about by women just as much because it seems to so affect the relationship if a man has problems with erection. And nowadays, with all there are many medications, for instance, that affect older Americans' ability to attain or maintain an erection. And often doctors, because they only get an average of 2 hours of sex education in their entire medical school training, don't know that just changing that medication to another high blood pressure, for instance, medication, or changing the dosage will solve the problem. And so this interferes. By the way, another American myth is that a man has to have an erection in order to have an orgasm and an ejaculation. In fact, ejaculation, orgasm, and erection are totally separate physiological functions, and a man can have a full orgasm with full pleasure and an ejaculation without ever being erect at all, which means that couples can have sex without intercourse, because, of course, there's lots of things men can do for women to help them to have pleasure sexually that don't include intercourse.
Well, I was wondering if for men they're concerned about their genitals, if for women they're concerned about their breast size, if that's what women worry about.
Right. Not nearly as much. That is way down the list. It's not even in the top 10. But it's true that the myth is that all American men like big-breasted women. In fact, there is research on that topic. Turns out that when you ask men what is important to them erotically in women, only half of the men that are questioned say that breasts are important. Of that half, only half of them say big breasts are what attracts them. In fact, the other half say they like small breasts. So it's really only 25% of American men that report that large breasts are an important factor in their erotic turn-on with women.
I'm curious how many letters you receive from men and women with a kind of general embarrassment about their bodies, whether it has to do with weight or the shape or odors or size.
It would end up actually to be a large number. We haven't analyzed it in that way, but I can tell you that overall, the major theme of almost all our letters is, am I normal? Hmm. And that has to do with all kinds of things and all kinds of behaviors. And of course, in a large majority, probably over 95%, the people are absolutely normal. The reason that they don't understand that is because since we don't talk about these topics and we have myths about the fact that, for instance, no heterosexuals have anal sex or everybody likes large penises and large breasts, those myths cause us not to discuss or ask other people about these issues and about our fears and concerns. And so many people live thinking they're the only person that either has this question or has this problem when, in fact, they are part of the majority.
How many partners do you think actually sit down and talk to each other about sex the way they might plan a weekend or a vacation?
I can't answer you with research, but I would bet that it's a tiny percentage. It's quite amazing how hard it is for couples, no matter what their age, to sit down and talk about sex. And I think one of the things that makes it difficult is that they don't realize that the time to talk about it is not when you're in bed and not right just after you made love. It's, in fact, you know, somewhere else. Long car rides are really a good place to talk about sex, because there it's not as likely to be taken as a criticism. But very few couples really sit down and talk about their sex life. And that's one of the reasons that good sex therapy works so well, in fact. It's not any magical thing. It's, in fact, people have given themselves the time to sit down and talk with a kind of a mediator about this very delicate subject. And a lot of things can be resolved in a very few sessions, because often what it is a communication problem.
Well, I think there's a kind of enduring belief that if you live with someone or you know someone very well and even love them, that they're supposed to know what you want.
Yes. They're supposed to read our minds about everything. And of course, human beings are not yet to the point where, like on Star Trek, The New Generation, that counselor can actually read people's at least emotions. We can't do that. And in fact, it is very important to tell your partner what feels good, what doesn't feel good, what makes you happy, what doesn't make you happy. And in fact, talk to them about all through the relationship, how you feel. But particularly in the sexual arena, it is extremely important. If we're going to have a long-term relationship, we're going to age together and change together and keep our sex lives exciting with each other. Communication, I like to say communication is the most important sexual lubricant.
Some people say that the brain is the biggest sexual organ that there is.
Yeah, that's another thing that we like to say, that the most important sex organ is not between your legs, it's between your ears.
I'm speaking with Dr. June Reinisch, and she's the director of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. How common are rape fantasies for women when they're having sexual fantasies?
Well, that's an important question because, again, another American myth is that if you have a sexual fantasy about something, it really means that that's what you want to do. And in fact, that is not true. The research that we've done at the Institute and that other researchers have done indicate that people fantasize to augment or increase their arousal. And one of the ways you do that is by fantasizing about things that are unusual. And they're very often things that in a million years the person would never do. One example of that, of course, are rape fantasies. They are rather common in women. There's never been a national representative random sample of women, so we don't know how truly common it is in the population. But women who are volunteer to be interviewed or take questionnaires about sexual fantasies, many of them report sexual fantasies that have to do with rape, but they do not want to be taken by force. And it's it turns out that, for instance, many, not all, but many heterosexual men occasionally have homosexual fantasies. That does not mean that they want to be homosexual or try homosexuality. And sort of as proof of that, in a way, is the fact that many homosexual men have heterosexual fantasies, which concern them, and of course do not mean necessarily that that's what they're looking to do.
Do people report to the Kinsey Institute that they are scared by the content of their fantasies?
Yes, people do, or at least concerned and anxious about it because they believe this myth that because they fantasized it, it means they really want to do it, which is not true. And once you tell them it's not true, they feel a lot better.
Dr. June Reinisch, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
Dr. June Reinisch is the director of the Kinsey Institute for Sex Research and author of the Kinsey Institute New Report on Sex. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.